You're listening to the TrekMate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. And tonight's episode is The Survivors. I'm James from London.
This is killing me. I'm a little distracted. I'm Lou from Nebraska. Cut the music. Okay. I just made the Star Trek intro stop.
And the synopsis for tonight's show is the Enterprise investigates two survivors living on the only undamaged patch of land on a devastated planet. This is the third episode of Season 3 of Star Trek The Next Generation. It originally aired on the 9th of October, 1989. It was written by Michael Wagner and directed by Les Landau. Tonight's guest stars are John Anderson as Kevin Uxbridge and Anne Haney as Rishon Uxbridge.
Oh, this is killing. What? Can you hear this music?
No, I cannot.
You don't hear any music playing?
I hear no music playing.
Since just before we started recording and all through the intro, I've been hearing this stupid music. And it just won't go away. It plays from beginning to end. It'd be one thing if it was playing it all the time, but there seems to be a half a second pause and it just won't stop, dammit. And I know what's happening. I know it's Paul Finch. Paul Finch is doing this. Paul, you need to stop it. I can't take it, Paul. Now can you hear this music?
I still hear no music.
Oh, good lord. Maybe if I hit myself in the head like... Oh, there we go. It stopped. Okay, sorry. I'm sorry, where were we?
So, what do we think about this episode?
Which episode is it? Oh, The Survivors.
The Survivors, yes.
Yes. This is the one where Deanna was hearing music too.
Apparently, yes, that's right. Now, do you think most of the Deanna hatred of, you know, ooh, I have a headache, comes from this episode?
No. Because... I think maybe Deanna's being tortured and some might find that appealing.
Perhaps. I've always had a soft spot for this episode, by the way. I quite like it. I think that there are some things that get glossed over and... You know, rewatching as an adult, you realise that, you know, there's a bit of genocide going on that gets brushed off in the last 2 minutes. But I enjoy this episode, and it feels kind of like a very old school Trek, or almost like Outer Limits in its or Twilight Zone-y in its kind of grand setup. So I enjoy this episode. How about you, Lou?
Oh, I agree with you completely. Rishon Uxbridge is... I've always liked Anne Haney. And do you know where she's at in another Star Trek episode?
I believe she comes back as the Bajoran Arbiter in one of the courtroom scenes in DS9.
Mm-hmm. Dax.
Yes, it would be.
Yes, and I thought it was fun. She's. I think she's hilarious there. I think she said something like, you know, gentlemen, I intend to be here until Tuesday, not senility. So, yeah, she's funny. But
I quite like her. I think actually both the performances of the guest stars this week are good. Mm-hmm. And in particular, they get a fair amount of screen time. It's not just a kind of, you know, one or two lines and you miss it.
Right. Okay, so Captain's log. You know, we hurried. We swear we did. We received a distress call from Delta Rana 4, a Federation colony, but when we arrived, there was no one left alive. I mean, no... Wait a second. What's that? Oh, I'll be back. End of log.
Oh.
Delta Rana 4 has three moons. Now, what does our moon really do? It helps with our tides, right? Our ocean tides?
Well, I mean, I suppose it doesn't. It's not that it helps with the tides. It causes the tides to a very large extent.
Okay, so if we had three moons,
mm-hmm.
we'd be in a lot of trouble. I mean, there'd be a lot of action going on our planet, so I wonder what kind of effects it has on Rana 4.
Well, I mean, okay, so the moon...
Get your books out, kids, because Dr. Roberts is about to school ya!
The reason why the moon has an effect on the tides, it the moon gets closer to the Earth and then further away from the Earth, kind of in a periodic fashion. So it orbits the Earth in an ellipse, and that means that it will pull us more or less, depending on whether it's further away or not. Mm. And that means that it will pull the oceans with it, because that's the fundamentally, it's the least secure part of the planet. Mm. You could have three moons, and if they're all small, then it might not do anything. So it doesn't, it is more of the mass of the objects out there. But the interesting thing is that if you do have more than one significant massive object in orbit, you would probably have a really quite weird dynamic. Mm. Whereas, everyone knows that you've got the cycles of both the moon and then also the tides and things like that. If you had more than one in play, you might find that it's, you might have between high and low tide, one day it would be 5 minutes and the other day it would be 2 hours, mm. just because of the interacting system. So I think it would be cool because of the interacting system. Hmm. You really weren't asking for that answer, were you?
No, I figured we'd be messed up. I don't know.
It could work. I mean, lots of I think we are the only planet that has been discovered that has one major satellite. I mean, I think with the exclusion of, if we're keeping Pluto out of this. So all of the other big planets, they have more than one, except obviously the two closest to the sun that have none.
Yeah, but is Pluto a planet?
Not anymore.
That's what I'm saying. According to the Big Bang Theory.
No, it got downgraded. It got downgraded like 4 years ago or so.
Yeah. Okay. So there are supposed to be over 11,000 inhabitants in this colony, and for some reason there's absolutely none. So I have to ask. Now, we all know how this story plays out. The Hushnok, or whatever they're called. Mm-hmm. What did they do with all the dead bodies? I mean, the planet looks, other than the Oxbridge plot of land, makes me think that the crystalline entity actually paid him a visit. I just don't see stacks of dead bodies anywhere.
Oh, no, so I've always... You're causing me to doubt my original opinion on this, but I always thought that they just had a kind of like a defeat by aerial bombardment from orbit.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get the impression that the aliens came down, so I thought they effectively bombed the planet into submission, and with that you kind of like effectively obliterated it, very much similar to what the crystalline entity would do.
Yeah, that is what Kevin said. They did it from orbit. We never saw their faces. They took our world apart piece by piece. But, of course, then again, when he says we never saw their faces, we don't know who they are. Those were some lies. So we don't know for sure what all he knows or doesn't know. But I'm still curious, though. There's no dead bodies anywhere.
Oh, I assume that they had been vaporized away in phaser and other explosions.
I suppose, and the houses and the roadways, and the way Worf described it, that everything is just gone. Vegetation, no mm-hmm. roads, no wind. I don't know. It just kind of sounded very. And then when you look at the picture or the video of the planet and surrounding this plot of land, it looks very crystalline entity ish.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. And I do like the. I like this episode's setup in particular, because pretty much out of nowhere, we just say, hey, we're going to go and see a planet, it's being attacked by people, and then they get there, it's a pretty much a lifeless planet that's been, destroyed. So there's a bit of a mystery there already. And then you just see this patch of grass, And I think it's a nice story, right, of the, you know, the one surviving member from a horrendous attack, or, you know, the one surviving ghost that you might even consider it to be in this case. I really like the way that this is set up. And you know from the beginning, you've got this geometrically perfect square in the middle of a factory, kind of complete devastation. Somewhat similar to the Royale, right, where that's, you know, that looks like a horrendous planet except for one particular place where you can beam down. I think it's a nice setup, and it intrigued me, certainly when I was watching this the first time round.
Yeah. Okay, so the question was asked, did they escape the planet? And they said, no, Rana 4 possessed no interstellar spacecraft. Then how did they get there?
Well, bits and pieces of this episode make me feel like this is like a retirement village for old people in the 24th century. And the idea of if you consider it nowadays, they say, oh, you know, we're going to get and take you down to the retirement village. I'm afraid there's no form of car to get out of the retirement village. We just drop you off by bus. Mm-hmm. So I assume they got dropped off by some type of public, you know, interstellar transport, waved goodbye to their families, and were left stranded on this planet, defenseless. Mm. So it's a tale of how we treat our old people.
Pretty much. So basically, if they want to leave this planet and go visit relatives, they're going to have to wait till the Greyhound comes around again.
It looks like it, yeah.
Okay, well, so they were just dropped off and left alone. After all, they are in their 80s, so to speak. Okay. Let's see. So, the Wonder Kid. Remember we discussed Wonder Kid?
Wonder Kid
finds a house, and Worf finds two life forms where seconds ago there were none. So Riker beams down with a pitcher of lemonade and a warm howdy-do. Oh, wait. No, that ain't what happened. But they wanted to find out what the heck happened there. What do you think of... he has gall, doesn't he? Non-functioning weapon.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I quite like the... It's a really weird juxtaposition, right? They've obviously found some type of futuristic-looking house of some description. Because I don't think many houses in the 80s, certainly not many houses in the 80s in the UK, would have looked like that. And inside, the interior is all very clean and very modern, I suppose, even for today's standards, let alone nearly 30 years ago. I like the idea of these guys beaming down and just standing in the backyard, effectively trying to, you know, introduce themselves. And the other guys come off and basically do the "get off my land" speech. Also, it's good that Riker gets what's coming to him. He shouldn't be trespassing.
Right. I mean, they were trespassing three times. I mean, they just walked right into the house. It's, you know, breaking and entering. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Picard never gets charged for his crimes.
No, indeed.
So Deanna is telling Picard that there just seems something odd about these humans. I can't quite put my finger on it. So if that's the case, why didn't she beam down with Riker? I would have thought she'd make an excellent tricorder, so to speak, to, you know, get close to these people and see what they're about.
I think that's a valid point. Although, you know, they obviously did, they beamed down with a fairly heavy crew, right? So they beamed down with Geordi, Data, Worf, Crusher, and Riker, to my recollection.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, obviously Crusher's there in case of any injuries and stuff, and the others are probably there to, you know, get around this mystery of the planet still being completely destroyed except for this one location. I think that they just didn't put too much, too much into Troy's warning at this stage. I have to say, I like what happens to Troy in this episode, and I don't mean I like, you know, Troy being, you know, punished and going crazy or anything. All too often we run into aliens, and if you were to actually think about the reality of the situation of a telepath or an empath being on the other side, you know, that would possibly be a threat. And this is one of the only instances I can think of where the bad guys, or, you know, the antagonist at least, they go after disabling the empath in order to protect their secret. And I think that that seems to be a logical thing to do, in my mind.
Oh, it would be, but that would make him an empath as well, to be able to sense that she's sensing him.
No, sure, and that later transpires to be the case. I just think that I think it makes sense that some people wouldn't want. So far, we've seen Troi. She kind of pokes into people's minds, and a couple of episodes ago, there was someone saying that please don't scan me with your mumbo jumbo brain brain feeding magic waves. But realistically, it would be it's a pretty big weapon that the crew have at their disposal.
Oh, yeah.
And when you come up against people that have something to protect or to hide, they're going to probably not be that impressed by Troi coming down and reading their thoughts. So I was just thinking about this earlier, and I thought that Troi being taken out just makes absolute sense. And we also know why this guy has something to hide, and Troi didn't pick up on it because she was taken out explicitly. All too often, we have bad guys, they have something to hide, but Troi doesn't notice. And the reason why she doesn't notice is that, frankly, the writers just don't know how to nullify her, what fundamentally is a superpower. So I really enjoyed the kind of the realistic way that you would take out the empath if you did have something to hide. I think the only other occasion I can think of it happening, unfortunately, is Nemesis, which is in a not good situation.
Right. Well, and another thing is, music wasn't all that bad. It was a nice little melody. So, it'd be different if she was being tortured with, say, some Motley Crue.
You think that's what they should have done? Like some thrash metal going on in the background. Or maybe what's your name? Maybe just some Europop stuff that gets into your brain and then you literally can't get it out.
Yeah, or hit her with the little scar face.
Now the funeral is over, and all the tears are dried up. It's hanging deep on the cut, getting fired up. Looking for a who pulled his pistol on my homie. An eye for an eye, so now your life is what you owe me. Look deep into the eyes of your motherfucking killer. I want you to witness your motherfucking murder, nigga. And since you wants to kill, then your ass has got to fry. But ain't no police, therefore your ass has got to die. I've got my pistol pawn cocked. Ready to link shots non-stop until I see your ass drop. And let your homies know who done it. Cause when it comes to this gangsta shit, you mother know who run it. So when you put this motherfucker to the test, you gotta realize something. You f*** with the very best. I've got this killer up inside of me. I can't talk to my mother, so I talk to my diary.
Okay, so, and that's something you've never heard of before. But don't worry, you ain't missing anything. Okay, so Diddy gives her history as botanists. But holy cow, he gets the ages wrong, supposedly. He says, Rashaan is 82 years of age when Anne Haney dies 11 years after this episode aired at the age of 67. And then he says Kevin is 85 years of age, and John Anderson actually died 3 years after this episode at age 69. So why is it, do you think, they aged him so much?
Oh, I think that from the episode's perspective, from the episode's perspective, these are supposed to be retired people going off to live on a colony somewhere. I think they're expected to be old and elderly. I think that they've just got younger actors to play them so that it demonstrates that in the future people are going to be healthier and quote-unquote younger for longer.
Well, it's not like they're on the Norpen colony, which we'll find out later is pretty much a retirement home area. But actually, they went to this planet to help colonize this world, and that's why the question asks, why did you come to a new planet like this when you did? You mean at our old age? So,
but that's still 50 years younger than McCoy is, right? but yeah. at this stage. I think McCoy was, what, 135 or thereabouts?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
and one thing I hope, right, is that, you know, as people get, you know, as people live longer, I hope it's not that you still, you know, I hope you don't hit senility at like 85 and you've just got an extremely long death awaiting you until 135. I assume that medical advances pushes out the quality of life into your hundreds and 110s and 120s in Star Trek.
You think when... I'm trying to remember if DeForest Kelly died during the run of TNG or not.
No, I think it was afterwards.
It was afterwards. Because I was thinking, you know, had he died during it, then they may have had something in an episode about Dr. Crusher talking about, you know, the great-grandfather of Starfleet Medical just passed away today. And that'd have been a nice tribute. But, of course, he was still alive, so it doesn't matter.
I think if memory serves, DeForest Kelly was the first to go, and I think it was in 1999, something around then, if memory serves. And then I think, yeah, I mean, Jimmy Doohan would have been, I think, 5 years later, something like that. But don't quote me on that. And don't record this and publish it. So
don't record what and publish it? The you not knowing part?
Yeah, indeed.
Oh, boy. So anyway, okay, so Riker wants to go into the house and maybe see how some magic works. So, but Oxbridge tells Riker he doesn't get to look at anything without a warrant. Oh, no, he never said that.
He didn't say that.
He didn't say that. Go ahead. Go on in. You know, we're not hiding anything. Don't look at that white powder that's on our table, though. Yeah, it's sugar.
So that's what you think the wife is doing at the moment, flushing their stash.
Exactly. Kevin, what are you doing? I already threw it all away. Yeah. Let's see. So he lets him inside to see the house, the inside, and I believe Riker heads on up to the bedroom. Hey, they may have a granddaughter there. but that's when they start playing with the music doll, the little trinket. I can't remember, music dollhouse or whatever it's called. And at this, do you think that at the same time that this is picked up and the music starts playing, that Deanna hears it in her head, or do you think she's been hearing it since they arrived?
That's a good question.
I'll tell you what I think. I think she is just hearing it because she seems to be walking around her quarters going, "What?" You know, it's not a Jesus. I wish this would stop. It's a what? What is that? What am I hearing?
I think it's certainly... So the episode is certainly cut so that those two things coincide.
Yeah.
But whether they coincide for thematic reasons or whether they coincide because it is a linear progress in time, I don't know. And actually, I don't think it... I'm going to claim that it doesn't matter.
No, I suppose it doesn't. Okay. Let's see here... Troy wants to go to her quarters. Oh, yeah, conference. You know, who are these people? Counselor, what do you sense? I don't sense anything. I just want to go to bed. And Picard says, by all means. What does he mean, by all means? I mean, how many means are there to get to her quarters? Say, a turbo lift, maybe a walk to her room, two means at most, maybe three. How many means are there?
So do you not use by all means in a...
No.
In the U.S.?
Mm-mm.
Oh, I mean, really? Do you not? You don't use that expression? Because it's extremely common in the U.K. to say by all means. It just means that you have no objections. And I suspect, you know, when you say, can I do this? You say by all means. I suppose historically it would be linked to the fact that you would allow them to do it in whichever way they deem to be appropriate.
Okay, well then I was thinking, well, let's come up with some more means besides just walking to her quarters. But they can beam her in.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I've always thought that the Enterprise needed a slide between decks. So you don't have to go on the turbo lift, but you can just go down the slide.
Whee! Says Picard. Okay. Let's see what else. I mean, she can go through the Jefferies tubes.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if there is an emergency staircase, you know, in case of fire, you go down the stairs, don't use the elevator. Or they could put her on a shuttle and cut a hole in her window and she could just walk in there.
And she could seize some other person's quarters. and claim them as her own.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so...
You know, don't go to the quarters, get the quarters, come to you.
Right. So when Ensign Kevin wakes up in the morning and finds Deanna laying next to him...
Well, I think he'll be in for a treat.
Mm-hmm. We didn't. Did we? Oh, God. God, I was kidding when I said I wanted to... Never mind. Okay, so let's see here. Oh, waiter, I'll take one reputation with a stack of embarrassment, please. Worf stakes his reputation that whatever destroyed this planet is gone, but unimpressed. Picard tells him a little story about an admiral once saying the same thing about some renegade Andorians, and it seemed they had dismantled their ship. So I guess a curious question is okay, so the renegade Andorians dismantled their ship. Now what? I mean, what'd they do with their ship after that?
Well, I'm a bit confused. How quickly can you dismantle a ship and kind of disperse it so that it wouldn't be picked up on sensors? Because you're given the impression that the thing you pick up on sensors is like the warp drive, or you might pick up the fuel resources. You know, so you've got huge piles of antimatter, right? Mm-hmm. Surely that's going to be visible on a sensor somewhere. So the idea of you actually just taking apart your ship and putting it into pieces, you've still got the big warp core somewhere, unless you're going to dismantle that. And you're still going to have the antimatter unless you're going to get rid of it somehow.
Dump it down the toilet.
Yeah, well, I get... It's a... The impression you give is that if you hide it in smaller pieces, then you're not going to be able to find it on the sensors. But I think that's very much a throwback to how we currently do, you know, reconnaissance, or we have radar, where we're effectively just relying on, you know, some signals to bounce off a piece of metal and to come back. And if you effectively take it all apart, then you don't have that issue.
Mm-hmm.
But I like how Worf, Worf doesn't need to do this, right? He, from the perspective of the episode, this doesn't need to be part of it. But I like the way that Worf tells him that, hey, you know, they didn't have anyone as thorough as me to contend with. and you know that he's going to get his comeuppance a little bit later on, through no fault of his own. Although you can see when he does get it wrong and the ship does come back, comes back the first time, you can see the Worf is sitting there going, I don't understand it. I'm so embarrassed. I'm going to have to resign over this. I'm out of Starfleet. There's only one honorable way out, and that's through kind of like, you know, ritual suicide.
Yeah. Oh, I lived on this humiliation. Anyway, that was a different episode, but... Okay, so Picard visits Deanna in her room and tries to hit on her. No, he doesn't. She tells him the music is playing from start to finish, over and over. She doesn't even know what music it is. Neither do I, in fact, because I can't find the name of the music. Tao classical music is the best I can find. So he tells her to get some rest and take the necessary sleep inducements if necessary. Or take the necessary sleep inducements, and I'm wondering what those might be. You think they have a little Tylenol PM? In her drawer somewhere, or a little Ambien. I mean, wonder what kind of sleep inducements. It seems like they always put something on their head, and within a few beeps, they're out.
Yeah, you would have thought that. I don't know. I don't know whether that's only just when you're in sick bay they can do that, or whether the people have access to that from a recreational perspective. But you can imagine, you know, having a big nice switch off button, with, you know, thingy to the head. Bloop. I don't know, you'd have to then make sure that it turned itself off after like 8 hours, otherwise you might be there for weeks.
Yeah, that's true. You haven't eaten in days, yeah. Where's Mr. Crusher? Oh, I think he's still in his quarters. He's got that thing on his head. Okay. And like you said, a ship comes out of nowhere and Worf just can't explain it. Waiter! This reputation is stale. I'd like a fresh one, please. I don't know what to say.
He's poor guy. No, and you can see Worf really squirming at this point, which is nice.
Mm-hmm. That's always fun to see. So the ship fires on the Enterprise with 40 megawatts of power. And I was wondering, 40 megawatts, that doesn't sound like much more than what I'm using to record this on this computer. So maybe you can tell me, what's a megawatt? Or, you know, I mean, how many megawatts would a computer take?
No, I think it's around, it's probably about one and a half. Well, that's for the computer part. By the way, I know this because I built my own computer and I had to buy my own adapter thingy-majiggy that goes into the, that powers it. I'm sure it's got a proper name. I think it's like a 1200 watts that you try to get for your PC, that depending on what you need to run. So 1,000 watts would be a kilowatt, and a megawatt would be a million watts. So it's not a huge number. Even by today's standards, it's not a huge number.
I see the desktop computer, 60 to 250 watts. So apparently, maybe they are using a little bit more than the computer by about a million over. Yeah, maybe 39 and a half million more than what I'm using. So, okay. So Riker says that, well, if that's the best they can do, this should last about 5 minutes. So I'm curious why it would take so long. And I'll tell you why. I mean, the Enterprise, if this is the case, they could just fire one shot and they'd be done. But they can't. Federation policy is to never fire back at an opponent who is firing on you unless they cause severe damage to your ship, have killed a minimum of 3 expendable crew members, and then you can only fire phasers that cause little or no damage to the other ship. Only when you're on the brink of death are you allowed to defend yourself with photon torpedoes, assuming, of course, that they're still online. Now, does that sound about right?
That does sound right, although you'd never get to the point. It would take too long for the other guys to kill those 3 expendable crew members.
Mm-hmm. Well, right, at 40 megawatts, but, you know, if they were a Romulan ship, it wouldn't take that long. So, 5 minutes. Yeah. So, Picard says, fire a warning shot across their nose. No, he didn't say across their nose, but fire a warning shot. So, what do you think the other ship might be thinking? Oh, these people are lousy shots. They missed us by about 3 ship lengths.
Well, it is strange, right? Because what happens is that the other ship fires, and the Enterprise goes, these guys are weak. And then we don't fire at them, and we completely miss them. But we're expecting them to think, well, it's lucky they missed us because they clearly are powerful. So, you know, maybe the shot, the 40 megawatt shot that we got was just a warning shot. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is hey, Enterprise, this is us turning it down as low as it can possibly go. You know,
right.
Maybe that's what they were firing. But we kind of assumed that this was the most that they could fire.
Yes. And, of course, you know, after the bad shot that we just did, they fly away and the Enterprise initiates pursuit. But the hostile, as Lieutenant Yar called it in the pilot episode, you know, Q, is matching the Enterprise's acceleration curve point per point. Okay, so they were going warp 2, warp 3, warp 4, warp 4.5,
warp 5, warp 5.5.
Riker to the Forge. Give us everything you can to close that gap, Geordi.
Yes, sir. I'll get you to 9.37 in 15 seconds.
Warp 8.75. Warp 9. The warship continues to match our acceleration curve perfectly.
And it just kept accelerating along with them. And finally, Geordi opens up the afterburner hatch, puts in a little of this liquid, and we're now hitting 8.75. Warp 9. And they still was able to maintain their acceleration curve. So I'm curious how they were able to do that.
So who do you mean? Do you mean how did the Enterprise keep up, or how did the ship ahead of them match the Enterprise?
Well, let's assume the ship ahead was at warp 4, and we were at 4.5. But as soon as they went to 4.5, the other ship went to 5, or they matched their acceleration curve to where the Enterprise was just not catching up. You would think that it would take a couple seconds to initiate the next one, or they would accidentally go one warp speed ahead of us or half a warp speed behind us. But yeah, they were matching perfect.
No, exactly. And I think this is where Picard starts to realize that they are being played with.
Yeah.
So I think what it is that, you know, there's clearly someone else involved, and they are not, you know, these guys aren't running away as fast as they can. That they, it's more like a child, where if you're being chased by a three-year-old, you kind of stay two steps ahead of them, and they think that they're going to get you, and you just, you're in control. And I read it like that. So it was, regardless of what the Enterprise did, the other ship was going to stay, you know, just that much further ahead. And, you know, fundamentally, it became too obvious, right, that they were playing with the Enterprise. But that's, I think, how why Picard starts thinking, something's not quite, you know, something's not quite right here.
Well, the one thing we haven't said yet is I don't even believe that ship was real. Completely illusion.
No, it is a complete illusion, yeah.
Yeah. So they return back to Rana 4, where Picard shows up with Mr. Reputation and a food slot. Food slot. Sorry. You didn't laugh anymore. I guess we need to go back to Replicator.
We do.
Yeah, yes. So one of those two sulks, while the other gives them clean food, clothes to eat, and fresh water.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems like it, in complete honesty, right? He brings this box down, and he basically gives it to them and says, look, with this, you don't have to do anything for the rest of your life. I mean, if you imagine receiving that, you don't have to work again. Right, you just sit down, you'll replicate yourself a couch, you'll replicate yourself a television and the complete series of Star Trek, and you'll just replicate Doritos for the rest of your life, and it'll be fine. And, you know, that's pretty cool.
Okay. I'm surprised, Doc, you didn't pick up on that, by the way. I'm sure a couple people have already rewinded to say, what did Lou just say? Yes, I actually did say, gives him clean food, clothes to eat, and fresh water. So
I didn't catch that.
Yeah, you didn't catch that. Sorry. For all of you who picked up on that, good shot. And you can tell us in the forums how many times you rewinded that to figure out why I said that. So Deanna is at the brink. Oh, and of course, they don't want the replicator, which is suspicious in itself because, I mean, they're not going to be able to take care of themselves in a couple of years. The water is tainted. So, yeah, I would have taken the replicator. But here's a question, though. What powers the replicator?
Well, it depends. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what it's supposed to be. It could be a couple of things, right? It could be extremely good batteries that are going to last for 50 years. It could just be, you know, it could have so much power in there that you don't have to worry about it. A bit like when, I don't know, I suppose nowadays, I think now there's a lot of our gadgets, right, to get into the point that they run out of batteries much quicker than before. But I remember the olden days of good mobile phones, and a full charge would last you a good week and a half.
Yeah.
It could just have batteries with it, or it could, if it had the ability to do some sort of micronuclear fusion, you could happily just take a couple of atoms out of the air, fuse it and get nuclear-powered replicators. That would work.
Perhaps. Or maybe the replicator just replicates its own power and gives itself back its power.
But the replicator has a way of, you know, turning energy into matter, despite the fact that I don't like saying that because it makes no sense. But it has matter. You know, it'll probably sit on a table somewhere or sit on the garage. It could go off and it could find other matter to turn into energy and then use that energy to turn into other matter. Huh. So it might, you know, there's a whole planet for them to consume.
Right. Well, I was just thinking the replicator could actually take a little bit of its own energy and use it to replicate a lot of more energy. I mean, I suppose if you have something that uses gasoline that can actually create a tank of gasoline at a time, then it would just continually supply its own energy.
I think that technically violates the third law of thermodynamics.
I suppose. Okay, I'll take your word on that.
I think it's the third. It might be the second, but please write in.
So Deanna is on the brink of madness, and of course there's a poor ensign standing next to her as she's screaming her pleas. I'll do anything. And just as you hear some Barry White music coming on and the ensign begins to do a sexy dance. Nope. Dr. Crusher interrupts him.
Yeah, it's not the third. It's the second. I'm sorry.
Well, that's okay.
In the sense that you can't, what's it? You have conservation of energy, and also you don't have a perfect machine that can give you more out than you put in. Anyway.
Can't give more out than you put in.
Where were we?
So what do you think about Marina's performance today so far?
So I mentioned this right at the beginning of the show as to whether or not this is the episode that makes people kind of roll their eyes with Troy and saying, look, she's always got a headache and so on. And this is one of the... We've had other kind of Troy-centric episodes, and this one isn't Troy-centric, right? This is just a very much a Troy B-plot kind of, Troy in a plot part of the episode. I like it. I really do. I think it makes a lot of sense. I didn't have any problems at all with Marina Sirtis's performance on this. And, you know, we came through season one and season two, and there have been some of the Troy heavy episodes. And I've kind of, you know, I've warmed to her a lot more than I recall being at this stage. So I didn't have any problem, but I do know that, you know, whenever you talk to anyone about Troy, they say, oh, yeah, has he got a headache again? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's either this episode or I think, you know, is it The Loss where she has big problems with losing her ability and getting upset about that? And those episodes, these ones get always brought up as being, you know, the horrendous Troy performances. And I don't see it. So I'm a bit of an apologist. So am I out of line here, Lou?
Absolutely not. I thought she did a wonderful job here. I mean, she was a victim. No, it isn't. The Troy headache is a product of bad writing. They just didn't know what the hell to do with her. But no, I mean, I think they used her great this week. Somebody was actually assaulting her, I guess you could say.
And I have to say, I had a huge amount of empathy for the character because... You know, and as the viewer, you're a bit of ahead of both Troy and the Picard because you see the cut going from Data picking up the music box to Troy now hearing the music. So, you know, you're a little bit ahead and thinking there's something funny going on, something linking these two, these two things that, from a plot perspective, are very isolated. But you know, I was very much, you know, for want of a better word, I was concerned about Troy and thinking that, well, something's happening to her and it's very hard. It's a real hard place she's been put in. And then if you look at it from a plot perspective, it really makes a lot of sense that, you know, the guy that is hiding something needs to prevent the empath from, you know, from reaching it. And no one else on the ship realizes that this is what's going on until right at the end when he fundamentally comes back and tells them that's what's been going on.
Mm-hmm.
So I like it. I thought Troy did well. And actually, if I'm not mistaken, this is Troy's... I think it's not leotard, but her big green dress. I think this is the first time we see it.
Is it?
It's the like the blue greeny dress that stays around for quite a while that has a fair amount of It's Troy's dress.
It's lopsided.
It's lopsided. It's a nice lopsided dress.
Yes. In other words, the right side gets a little more daylight than the left side for some reason.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so no, I thought she did a wonderful job here. And then, like you said, The Loss, I think she does a great job there too. So we'll get to that.
I think we're going to be known as a Troy apologists.
We might. And, although I am not a Marina Sirtis apologist. As you know, I've been listening to the mission log, and I have actually started. I'm now starting Star Trek, the original series, and just like I did with the Gamma Quadrant, like I'm doing with the Upper Pylon 2, I watch the episode and then I listen to the review.
Mm-hmm.
But the mission log also has supplementals, and the first one I heard was Will Wheaton. Terrific. Heard a lot of stuff from Will. Then another one I heard was from Marina, and I thought, mm-hmm. God, what a bitch. I mean, she is really unapologetic. You know, when William Shatner did that Get Alive thing, that was all put on. That was all staged. But yes, her, she is completely unapologetic of these people that are just freaks. I mean, she considers all Trekkies freaks.
Well, by the way, I mean, I've seen Marina Sirtis at conventions, and she does put on that front. You know, that is what she does, and she's very much, you know, she likes. She's not there to pander to the fan base. I don't think that's certainly not what's going on. And you know, I think from her perspective, she, you know, she believed that she was going over to to Hollywood. She was going to star in, you know, shows. She was going to become a big movie star kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And you know, I don't get the impression that she was a sci-fi fan or anything like that. Whereas, mm-hmm. if you think from Will Wheaton's perspective, you know, he's a self-confessed nerd that thinks that this is probably the greatest gig in the world. So I think that it's generally, you know, I think it's the guys that come in, like in Trek or like in sci-fi in general, that you can really tell that they have a, you know, I think they have a great love for the show and what it then becomes. And it's not just in, you know, it's not just Will Wheaton, but I think people like, you know, Robert Picardo as well, he's well known for being a, he likes the fan base. He also likes the, you know, the rest of the stuff that goes along with Trek, not just the Trek stuff, but the sci-fi stuff too.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And then I know people from the opposite end of the spectrum. I'll tell you, I don't know if you've ever heard of a stand-up comedian called Gabriel Iglesias.
I do not know.
Ah, he's Mr. Fluffy. He's Fluffy Man. He is big. He's tall and he's big. So that's why they call him Fluffy. He says there's several different names for sizes. It's big, husky, fluffy, and damn.
Okay.
So I don't know if I'm between a fluffy and a damn. But anyway, Gabriel Iglesias, he's the type that says, you know, if you see me out somewhere, you see me anywhere at a bar, at a restaurant or something, come up, talk to me. You're the one that's made all this possible for me. So he wants people to actually bug him. Hey, get a picture. You can get a picture with Fluffy anytime you want to. But her, on the other hand, hey, I did this as a job for 8 years, and now I'm going to milk it a little bit on conventions, but I don't expect you to, you know, just leave my ass alone. That's kind of what I got from her.
But also from her perspective, right, what does, you know, does the fan base love Troy? I mean, I think that, you know, I don't think, you know, without wanting to be too crude, I think that either people looked at Troy and thought, oh dear, there's that, you know, there's that woman on the show that has a headache all the time, and you know, people didn't like her episodes or anything. And I think the best you might have been able to say about it is that she happened to be there for a large number of teenage boys. And I don't think that she probably, you know, that's not a particularly proud moment for her if she's going over to Hollywood to do some proper acting.
True. That's true. I guess during conventions, she's probably had to deal with the number of, boy, I hated Deanna Troi. You're great. You're wonderful. You know, pandering her a little bit, but boy, I sure hated Deanna Troi. But the difference between her and Will Wheaton is you can go up to Will Wheaton and say, man, I really hated Wesley Crusher. And Will Wheaton say, yeah, I really hated Wesley Crusher too.
No, I know. But I mean, I think Will Wheaton has, you know, he has traveled over the last 25 years with the show. And, you know, it's the relationship that exists at the moment between Will Wheaton and his character hasn't always been there. So I think he's become very much more at peace with, you know, with Trek.
Oh, yeah.
And stuff. And, you know, obviously growing up, I think he's the guy, he does mention that he was on the internet early. And I remember, you know, does everyone else remember the Usenet forums? And you could go to the, you know, alt.tv.startrek.wesley.die. And, you know.
What dot what? Okay.
And if that's the kind of stuff that you're seeing when you're probably, what, 18, 19 or so, that's going to be pretty, you know, pretty freaky to deal with.
I suppose so. Usenet forums. That sounds familiar, actually. Okay, so Kevin wants to know when the Enterprise will be leaving, and Picard tells him about the encounter with the warship and how they were unable to affect it. But don't worry, You know, Kevin says, it's not going to hurt us. I mean, it all adds up to Kevin, but we just don't get it at this point.
And actually, I have to say that from my perspective, you know, if you when you rewatch this episode, you end up thinking, you know, well, clearly he's the guy. There's something weird here. And you can see how he's trying to kind of block various paths. He's also been dismissive of, you know, we don't need a replicator. And you know, why don't you need a replicator? And oh, we're going to be safe. So why do you think you're going to be safe? Now, a lot of this becomes clear at the end of the episode, but I think you could, on first watch in particular, I completely bought this as, you know, cranky old man trying to get these people out of his day.
Right.
And I think that that's, you know, that that's a strong part of this episode. You all of the way that he tries to block the crew from helping him, I don't think raised that many suspicions in me. And I think that's, you know, I always like it when the seeds are there in the episode that you don't catch the first time round.
Right.
And that's, by the way, and that's because I've in the past I have mentioned that I'm just slow at picking this stuff up. But it's good being slow.
That's fine. Okay, so Dr. Crusher knocks Troy out, but she's still wiggling like she hears the music. But unfortunately, we can't get any further in because the warship is back, and for some reason it looks much meaner than it did before. And in fact, this time, the warship hits the Enterprise square in the nuts. I mean, they hit him with 400 gigawatts of particle energy. Okay, Doc.
Yeah?
Okay, I'm sure a gigawatt is probably lots of megawatts, right?
Yeah, 1,000.
Oh, so a gigawatt would be less than a megawatt.
No. So a gigawatt is 1,000 megawatts.
Okay. So when they hit him with 40 megawatts, now they put it up about 1,000 times or 1 million times more?
I mean, I think I can't remember the exact numbers, but it was 1,000 times more, something like that. Just okay. Over 1,000 times more.
And that was particle energy. What's particle energy?
I think all that's saying there is energy that is being transmitted via a particle.
Okay.
Which within the standard theory, that means just energy. There's not much else there. Mm. So it's just a way of it's a way of introducing scientific sound and words into a dialogue. Okay. They just mean energy.
40 gigawatts of energy, or 400 gigawatts of particle energy. Okay, well, whatever it was massive to drop the shields not once, not twice, but three times a lady. It just kept every time they get hit by this thing, shields down. And then the second time when he says shields down, wasn't the shields already down? I guess he was having trouble getting the shields to raise. And then of course there's a third one, shields down. Poor shields.
Yeah, I mean, I think Worf's having a... I mean, through no fault of his own, Worf is having a pretty bad day today.
Yes, he is. So now it's time for the Enterprise to tuck tail and run from the playground. The bully got him. The bully of the neighborhood, but they're not going to give chase. So, the Enterprise. I mean, poor Worf. You know, he's doing the best he can. He screws up once. He can't keep the shields up, and now he's got to be on this ship that just tucks tail and runs.
Huh. That's certainly not a good day at the office for Worf.
Hell no, it's not an honorable day happening here. So his honor is gone. But anyway, back in Deanna's room, she's naked.
You don't know that she's naked.
Well, I don't know that she's naked, but she has a blankie on. But other than that, she's not wearing her shirt no more. It certainly doesn't look like it. And I have to ask why. I mean, does Beverly expect to do CPR, chest compressions, maybe a quick cut down for surgery? I don't understand why they had to, you know, take her top off. And you see that a lot in medical shows where they're always, you know, even on Star Trek. Or something's going on. I think Riker even got nakedified during his, that thing was sliding up his leg. Yeah. You know what I mean?
You're talking about In Shades of Grey.
Yeah, yeah. Why do they do that?
I think the idea of describing Shades of Grey is, you know, that episode with that thing sliding up his leg.
You know, it does dance on Riker's pants. Anyway, go on.
I generally think that if you're in a position where you need to have medical intervention, you probably need to be relatively naked. Just in general, right? I mean, as someone who's just recently come out of people giving birth, you don't know what parts of the body you need to access at short order.
I suppose so, but then again, I guess, you know, it's somebody's job to take these clothes off, so I was curious who on the ship got the task of getting Deanna naked. Will, maybe?
I think Riker came in and, you know, made it commander's prerogative.
Mm-hmm. You're dismissed, Ensign. I'll handle this one. Okay. But anyway, so the ship returns to Rana 4, and again, Mr. Reputation says there's no ship in the vicinity, but Captain. And of course, you know, I guess Captain grants his reputation back because there was no way he could have prevented it. And this time, Picard is beaming down again to end the saga. So he arrives to surprise Kevin and Rashaan, who are dancing to some soft melody as before. So, question.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think maybe if Troy had hummed a few bars of the music she was hearing, that Data might have realized it? It's the same music that's in that music box on this planet?
Yeah, I think so. I think that there was certainly the possibility of of connecting the dots earlier. Although, you know, to be honest, you know, Troy does come forward and she says, "Look, something's clearly wrong, and no one's within the plot. No one is putting the two issues together. So no one's putting together the fact that Troy has been effectively nullified from the telepathic ability and." And anyone expecting it to be anything due to the guys on the planet. So had she hummed, I think they could have found it out pretty early. I think it's reasonably realistic that they didn't bother because, in a way, I mean, as I mentioned, I think this is the first time they tried to take Troy and Troy's abilities out. And I think it's pretty unique in the show running. So, had this been happening every week, then I think I would have been a bit more suspicious and more on the ball.
Here they go again, attacking Troy in her mind. But you know, a couple things is that, you know, like you say, Picard even says, you know, hey, we're all hit with that melody that just won't leave. You know, the Guns N' Roses soundtrack, but it's not that. And she explains what it is, and while she's still wiggling after being put out by Crusher, you know, I think that's when he realizes what Kevin is doing. Kevin or Rashaan, or Kevin and Rashaan, they're trying to get her, they're cutting her ability. But a curious question, when they were at warp 9.5, chasing this other ship, do you think maybe the range from where they were on the planet is there a range that Kevin would have had no influence on her, or do you think maybe he just stuck a tape recorder in her head and is just playing over and over until he takes it out?
Okay, I think that is also a good question. I think that it could be either. I think that the way that he solves the problem at the end almost seems like it's a switch. So he's played something in there and he has now switched it off. Mm. But remember, you know, the stuff that he does impact people countless light years away on, you know, on other planets and stuff.
Incredible.
So I could imagine that, you know, there might be a sphere of influence that the Enterprise just never got away from, because he demonstrates, you know, huge range of power.
Mm. So they had they fallen for it when the Hushnok destroyed them? Fired on the planet and destroyed Kevin and Rashaan, and the Enterprise fell for it and said, well, I mean, because, you know, we glazed over that part, actually, where they come back, and they're not after the Enterprise this time. They go to fire on the planet because, you know, Picard throws the gauntlet down. For as long as you are alive, we will remain in orbit to protect you. It was the only condition the Enterprise was going to leave. So let's say that had happened. They fired on them. Oh, they're dead. Well, I guess there's no reason for us to stay. It's in break orbit warp 9. Do you think this stuff would have been with her forever? Or maybe after a while, they're so far away, he says, okay, I can turn it off now.
My instinct is that it won't be there forever. But I suppose, okay, so from the perspective of, it's Kevin, right?
Yeah.
It's Kevin. From his perspective, when they do leave, and he believes them to leave, he doesn't shut down Troy. So he doesn't shut down the music in Troy's mind. So maybe it would have been with them forever until he actually came and specifically turned it off.
Mm.
Because he does get surprised twice, right? So there's the issue where they get pushed away and he thinks that they're gone. And then there's the second one after effectively they get killed and then they reappear only a couple of minutes or hours afterwards. And in both those cases, he obviously believes that he is now alone, but he hasn't stopped the music in Troy's head.
It's a good point. Yeah, he is surprised. Why would he be surprised? You would think, with his abilities, he knows that they're still there or not. Good point. Okay. So anyway, so Picard destroys the warship with one tiny torpedo. He broke the rules and fired a torpedo at him, and it just destroyed instantly. So that's fascinating.
And you can see, by this point, Picard's already, he's already well ahead. He knows what's going on, and he at least, maybe he doesn't know exactly what the situation is, but he knows that there's, these people are linked together, and there's other stuff happening, and it's all not is what it seems to be. I think that the idea of, he obviously plants it in their mind that he's not going to leave until they die, and then the warship comes along, and then he kills them, and then they scan for survivors, and there's no survivors, and it all looks legitimate, but it all looks too neat, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when he then, the only thing that might be keeping them is that, hey, are we going to have to chase down this ship and bring them to justice? He fires a torpedo, and then they blow up. Again, it's all very neat. It's all very, very, as I think Riker mentions, there's no reason for them to stay because everything has been taken care of in a nice box and been wrapped with a bow.
Right. And I thought it was funny that every time when Picard comes back on the ship and here comes that warship again for the last time, everybody is arguing with him about each order. Shields, Captain? No. Weapons, Captain? No. It's going to go for the planet. Okay, just relax. It's right on schedule. But they're going to destroy. Okay, just relax. Everything's cool. Let them do what they're going to do. I thought that was interesting, too.
Well, although it's a slightly poor house of management from Picard. He didn't tell anyone anything, and it's quite nice to be able to go on to the bridge and just watch everything unfold as you expected it was going to do, and then sit there and think, hey, aren't I cool? But he could have at least told Riker.
Yeah, right. But maybe Kevin couldn't read his mind. Because obviously, if that was the case, when he was in the house saying, the Enterprise will remain in orbit for as long as you live. I mean, you would think Kevin would have been able to read that this is a bluff. And so, therefore, had he said it out loud, that may have given away the game plan. So maybe that's why he couldn't say anything.
Yeah, it's like you said, possibly.
Yeah, because they surprised Kevin each time they showed up. What are you doing here? So obviously he couldn't read the thought that these people just arrived. So, but anyway, okay. So Picard beams them directly to the bridge where it accuses Kevin of this whole thing. Now, what's interesting? Did you when Kevin disappears and Geordi says he's in the turbo lift? What's fascinating is just before he disappears, Geordi, you could see Geordi's head turn to the turbo lift. So he actually, obviously tracked him with his visor the entire time to tell him he was in the turbo lift. So then,
yeah, I got that. I mean, it looked, it looked like he dropped off from, I don't know whether it's like a normal, normal human corporeal kind of existence to like an energy person. But I also got the impression that it was clear that Geordi was able to track him with the visor, and I thought it worked well. It was, once again, I think from the human's perspective, I could almost also read this as him disappearing and almost not being expected to be followed in any way.
Right.
So from his perspective, he thought he was able to fool the normal sighted guys, but it's just that because Geordi was there with the visor, they were able to give chase, I suppose.
And the turbo lift doors didn't open, so he was able to go through the walls too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So, they arrive to Deanna's quarters where he's standing over her with his hand out because he just saved her. And it turns out, or he just stopped the music and, he's sorry about that. It turns out Kevin is a Dowd, an immortal beating of disguises and false surroundings. Pretty much the same as Dr. Roberts here.
Oh, yes.
You scallywag. Okay. Yes. Not everything is as it appears. But what do you think of the end? Is kind of like pretty interesting. Not only, he kept telling the story along the way that he was not going to fight. And Rishon says, I wanted to fight too, but I didn't. And that's another thing we didn't talk about back an hour ago. Not everybody on the planet fought. I mean, that's assuming that 11,000 people, men, women, children, pets, they all fought. So if that's the case, why didn't anybody ask, well, Rishon, you may not have fought, but why isn't there anybody else alive? Not everybody was going to fight. And how could they fight? They were in orbit.
No, it was confusing to me as to what exactly they were asking. Is there any difference between you and anyone else? And he kind of volunteered the fact that he was a conscientious objector, for want of a better word, and he wasn't going to do anything, and he wasn't going to fight back. To me, I don't know what exactly it meant to fight back. I kind of, in my mind's eye, got a vision of a whole lot of people standing in the field waving their fists at a ship in orbit, because that's probably the most you could have done. So I don't think everyone else could have fought. And also, if we're talking about a whole planet, right, some of the planet would probably be asleep at the time. And so, to me, that didn't make a lot of sense. And actually, so all of the conversation so far has been about, kind of the plot and the mystery that there is. But also, as you kind of approach the climax, you have this big issue of, the morality of pacifism coming into the episode. And how this dude was an overly powerful dude that effectively chose to stay out of people's affairs, and he would not kill things. And I think I don't know if you're supposed to leave with the impression that he got to that position because of his extraordinary power, or whether he got to that position irrespective of his extraordinary power. I don't know, because I think if you have the ability to kill a billion people, you probably want to be sure of your moral standing on things than if you only have the power to kill, less than one or two before you effectively die yourself. Mm. But I thought it became an interesting... I mentioned at the beginning, it reminded me very much of like a Twilight Zone kind of moral framing of of almost a thought experiment. So very quickly it becomes, would you prevent death occurring on a grand scale by eliminating the enemy if you had the power to do it? And you had the power to do it also cleanly, because that's, I suppose, the thing that this guy has over anything that you would practically do. Whenever you go to war, there's always collateral damage, and this guy appears to be able to answer those questions. And you could really frame it in terms of, would you choose to kill in order to save lives? And, he, prior to the episode, reached the opinion that he wasn't prepared to do that. And, and that's a moral position that he can take. And in the event of him being caught up in it, he found his position unsatisfactory and effectively lost it. And when he did lose it, he took out everyone. And you can tell when he mentions that he killed them and he killed the, the attackers, Beverly's first instinct was, good. what, you know, is that what you're worried about? That's not anything to be concerned about. And I think from Beverly's perspective, she thinks it's completely morally acceptable to have killed the attackers, even if it is, you know, after the fact that everyone on the planet has died. And, you know, she sees that in a relatively, you know, relatively morally clean way. And then he has to explain to her, no, I didn't mean just the ship. I meant everyone. And it gets into what I think, you know, we have like 35, 40 minutes of this little dance around and various issues and, you know, a nice mystery. And then you get into this kind of moral story at the end. And it's very, for want of a better word, it's very Star Trek-y.
Oh, yeah, it was huge. It was a huge build-up to that moment, you know, when he says, you know, you don't understand the scope of my crime. I didn't kill 100, 1,000, even 1,000,000. I killed them all, you know. Everyone, all Hoosnock, everywhere. And like I said, men, women, children, doesn't matter. Assuming that they have men, women, and children, we don't even know who the Hoosnock is. But everywhere. And, you know, Picard says, we have no law to fit your crime. And I'm thinking, actually, I think we kind of do. It's called, genocide.
Yeah, I think we do, too. And I think you're completely on the money on this one.
So I'm curious, you know, obviously he felt bad for them. He probably just let them do what they want. But what if he wakes up one day because he's old and, you know, senile, and he decides to kill all packleds everywhere, all of them, no matter where they're from? Why don't we go back to them, go back to Kevin in a few years and say, we've got this enemy called the Dominion. Do you think you could do anything to help us? We're losing people by the thousands, by the millions. Do you think you could do anything?
No, actually, talking about the Dominion and, you know, DS9, this also is not exactly the same, right? But, you know, there were questions about, you know, higher beings' involvement in, you know, corporeal affairs with the, you know, wormhole aliens and the prophets. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, they had the power to intervene, and they chose not to. And, you know, they chose not to up until a point where Sisko effectively comes and, you know, tells them that it's time to interfere. And at that point, they take out the fleet. But it is interesting. It is something that is, it's high concept, kind of like sci-fi stuff. I personally think that the Kevin gets away with it here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he should. You know, I think from Picard's, when he sums up, he says, I don't know whether or not he's a man of... He sums up with something strange, saying, I don't know whether he's a man that should be pitied or should be feared or something.
Condemned.
I do think that he should be condemned, I'm afraid. I don't think you have the right to kill. You have the right to take such... first of all, unilateral decision to kill so many people, with the vast majority of them being effectively collateral damage. And it gets wrapped up in this story. But the character of Kevin, by the end of it, I think from the story's perspective, it looks upon him in a relatively sympathetic light.
Right.
And I think that's slightly out of place.
Okay. There's another question, though. Let's say, for instance, there was a law to fit his crime. Do you think he's going to let them take him into custody? Stand trial? I mean, I think I'd be more afraid of what's he going to do to all of us if we cross this guy.
I think the practical considerations are, you know, clearly this. Even if you wanted to try him, he kind of has to agree and play along with it.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, you know, there are even within like Earth's history, there are plenty of cases where people will, you know, they know they can't get at someone, and they will still try people in their absence, and they know that, you know, fundamentally it's nothing more than them just effectively clearing their conscience by going through due process. And I would have thought the Federation would probably be in that territory. They'd want to go through it, even if they, you know, they couldn't force the judgment upon the guy.
Right.
But I suppose it's pretty bad, right? If you do find him guilty, what's he going to do?
Yeah.
You've got two Andorians, a Vulcan, and three humans on the jury. And everyone except the Andorians votes that he's that he's guilty. Does he go and wipe out Vulcan and
Earth? Yeah, no kidding. Okay, well, so do you, last question I have is, do you think Picard took back the food slot? Okay, do you think Picard took back the replicator, or do you think it was destroyed when the warship fired on it? Or was that even an illusion that there was any destruction? But that's another question. Why didn't he just, whatever it was he did to hide the house and the plot of land, why didn't he just leave it there forever? Could Estelle made it the Enterprise for eternity?
I think the issue was that, so you have this guy that's very, very powerful, but you also have the appearance, at least, that he has to exist in our reality. So, you know, when he needs to exist with his wife in his nice little garden, he effectively has to build that rather than be in a position where he can kind of deflect a reality that he lives within from other people perceiving it. So it's a bit of a weird one, because very often you'd have, you know, people with great power have also great power of illusion to keep people away and keep people hidden. But this guy seems to he needed to live in the open despite his powers. So, but I think it's a valid point.
Okay. All right, I am pretty much done. This is one of the short shows this time.
No, it's not. It's not short. It's just that we've gone long on lots of them.
Yeah.
No. But I think that, yeah, I am also...
Okay.
I am also done.
Well, then, I think it's time to go on to our final thoughts and ratings on this episode on a scale of 1 to 5. And at 1 to 2, I'll give it a chance. With 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. You know, I don't even really have any final thoughts and ratings on this. This is just it's a pretty normal episode of Star Trek. The Enterprise gets fooled pretty easy. I like Worf being backed up into a corner and having to explain his previous error, which he obviously can't, but, you know, Picard lets him off, so he doesn't have to kill himself in his dishonor. So, Alexander, you're safe for now. We don't know who he is yet, but you're safe either way. It's an okay episode. I think it's all right. They could have solved the music in Troy's head a little bit sooner, just having her hum a few bars, but... I think she did a lovely job. I think Marina did a wonderful job. I'm not an apologist for her. It was some good acting. And she was a victim, and she really played being a victim the way it was supposed to be. So, but in the end, it's just really a mediocre to pretty good episode. So I'm thinking 3.5 for this one. What about you, Doc?
Well... I like this episode. I do like it. I think that there are some, I do think that Kevin gets off the hook a little too easily. I also thought that at times it tried to, I think it might have been trying to get too much of the message that being a pacifist is a bad idea, in particular in some of the earlier exchanges. I saw them... not necessarily trying to go down that path, but you could almost see that they wanted to. I really like this episode, though. I think that I like the Troy stuff. I think the Troy stuff really makes sense that happens. I think it's nice and unique that it does happen in this way. I remember watching this and being very surprised about where they were going and how it all kind of unfolded. Even the shows that we've had so far this season, I think that they have been, I think they've been better in general. I think the average shows have been kind of one step above from season two. So I think in season two, something like this would have been, more outstanding than it is in season three. And season three, it fits along with other episodes that are also great. I think it's I think it's a good show. I like it a lot. I'm inclined to give it a 4 because it's always been something it's something that stayed with me as, having watched this as a kid, and I always know which episode it is when people mention the survivors, and I think it raises some nice questions, and to me it gives me everything I need out of Star Trek. It's also very much standalone. You don't you don't rely on, you know, the alien of the week, although technically the dude is the alien of the week. You don't rely on, like, you know, funny looking dudes, or you don't rely on having to run into Klingons or Romulans to get your get your share of the action. I really appreciate this episode. So, okay, enough rambling. I'll say all right. 4 out of 5 from me.
And that's what I guessed at for you.
I think I'm running pretty high this season so far.
And you
it's
are.
Only going up. It's only going up.
It's only going up. Maybe someday you'll get a 5. You haven't gotten a 5 yet. It was a 3, 4, and now a 4. So we'll see next week. And who watches the Watchers? As far as I know, Data's coming on. We'll see if he does. I mean, we're already ditched once this season, so it can happen again, but I have a good feeling about it. I think Data will be there. What about you?
I think so, too. I think so. And actually, having said all of this, it's not long before I start getting annoyed with some episodes in season 3. And I think that there's one in particular that I think is very poor, but everyone else seems to think is wonderful.
The Price.
That's coming soon. No, The Price. Everyone thinks The Price is dreadful.
Okay, we'll see. Coming soon. And then after that will be Brian with the bonding. So, which, by the way, I really need to get with Denimore now before we record that, because you never know what could happen with poor Brian. Okay, so, hey, guys. One thing also you're going to notice, we're not going to do any forums right now. And the reason is, at the time we recorded this, the first episode, Evolution, just went out about a week ago. So I don't think, you know, we've got 3 forum feedbacks on it so far. And I'd like to build a little more, possibly. So we're going to wait even, I think we'll probably even skip next week, too, for Who Watches the Watcher. So we'll do forum feedback for Evolution when we record the bonding. So, anyway.
On the next episode of Star Trek, The Next Generation, a tragic accident exposes the crew to a savage alien race.
Crushed Enterprise, medical emergency.
Riker leads a secret mission to save a dying team member.
Riker, stop!
We will keep Troy captive.
But Picard must sacrifice his life for Troy.
He will kill me.
Father, no!
On Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Join us next week as we review episode 4 of season 3, Who Watches the Watchers? Watching the Mentakans, with our guest, Data Logan. So take care and good night.
Good night, everyone.
It's like we can tell the future. You know that?
It's almost like that, yeah.
Okay.
Can you hear a baby crying in the background?
Because I was going to say I heard Cassio a couple times, but...
Yeah, there's a little baby. She seems to be upset at the moment.
Oh, she's got a beautiful little English cry.
What?
You don't think so?
No, not really. The great things about babies is that people think babies cry, but they don't cry. They scream. So yes. You know, there are no tears. A toddler cries. A toddler has tears. A one-month-old doesn't have tears. It has a ferocious... kind of, you need to feed me scream. It's like, ha, ha, ha. But they're not upset.